So this ruin that was in the video, Göbekli Tepe, is, as you may recall from our having talked about it before, is the most ancient holy place that we've found to this point. It's about 12,000 years old, which, to put it in a little bit of context, to put it in the context perhaps of the Hebrew story from which the Christian story arises, this ruin would have predated Abram, as far as our best shot at it goes, by about 8,000 years. Would have predated Stonehenge by about 6,000 years. It would have predated writing by about 6,000 years. Would have predated any kind of metal tool making by thousands of years as well. In fact, it predated the development of agriculture by at least 5 centuries. I mean, this is a really old place. And one of the things that's intriguing about it is that it's ancient. Another is that what it is it's an enormous temple. In fact, it's a series of temples built in concentric rings over several centuries. And not only that, but in several layers. So they build one of these places, and then for whatever reason, we don't even have a good about this one, they'd shovel it in and they'd build another one and so on. There's several layers here, and that's hence the hill that caught the attention of the archaeologists in the end. If you read the blurb this week, you might remember that I used this analogy of squirrel tracks and of our dog Mika exploring these tracks as though each individual track contained the squirrel itself. Just the level of intensity was striking. Well, Göbekli, this ruin, is like an archaeological squirrel track. It's a place that marks the search for something. But the magnitude of this particular track, of this particular relic, suggests that the people who made it were just as inclined as Mika is, as we all are, to get stuck in the wrong sorts of places in their search for God. With anything ancient like this, and subsequently with the roots of our own story in terms of Christendom's story, with anything ancient, a lot of what we might take from it has to live first in our imagination. And I mean, you heard this artist talking about why he made a model. And it's because he's trying to imagine something, he's trying to picture something, and making a model of it helps him to get a little bit closer to what might have been, make a little better sense of the whole thing. And that's the way taking meaning from anything ancient works. So we have to start with what's going on in our imagination. So let's start, in this case, let's start here. Let's start with imagining a civilization that is just beginning to toy with the ideas of domestication. It's just beginning to toy with the possibilities of not being hunter-gatherer and nomadic, but of staying in one place and finding a way to exist and subsist in one location. That's sort of where we're at historically around this Göbekli thing. Survival in a culture like that is a tenuous thing. It depends on things growing, it depends on animals being present, and it depends not just on those things happening, but it depends on them happening in a way that the humans in the story can work with, can to some degree, I use the term advisedly, but to some degree depend upon. There will be a spring after the winter. The rains will come. There will be sun. Things will grow. The animals will migrate on the path that they did last year, at the time that they did last year, and the herd will be about this size. And because it goes past this cliff, we can, and so on. Right? These things become the things upon which survival depends. And along with this slow emergence over thousands of years, this slow emergence of established civilizations and of agriculture would have increasingly come the experience that there are some things that are essential for life that do not fall within the control of the humans in the story. But they're fundamental. And that would, as this head artist reminded us, that would have, among other things, prompted a series of questions. Big, way down deep on the pyramid kinds of questions, as well as way up high on the pyramid kind of questions. He sums it up by saying why, right? Which is, of course, a great question gatherer. If there are things in this situation that we're that the civilization is being formed in which we are living, that are essential to our survival, but they are not under our control, then whose control are they under? Right? The question kind of follows. Most of the evidence that we have, and even our own inclinations today, I think if we kind of stand back from ourselves and look from the outside in, suggest that we have as a species, when we're wrestling with the question, who controls the things that we do not control? When we're wrestling with that question, we have a tendency to look to what we would call the heavens, the realm of spirit. We look to the realms that we cannot clearly see or control to probe the question, who controls these things? We look up and we look down, right? We look to the heavens, we look to the deeps. We look to the realms in which we do not live and move and have our being comfortably. And we tend, as humans, to imagine that there are beings residing in those realms that have control over the elements, among other things. They have control over the things that we don't have control over. And we've had a tendency historically to call those beings that we imagine operating in those realms gods. Sort of how we put language around that exploration. And we know that we need these beings, which we're now thinking of as our gods, we need them to be on our side if we're going to survive. We need them to be for us. And so we start asking ourselves, we start trying to imagine what is going to help the gods to be on our side. What's going to get them to play nice about the things that we have to have or we'll die? And that very logically leads to a set of questions about what is under our control. What can we do that might bring the gods around? And what would appease them? What would make them happy? What would provoke their largesse? What would cause them to pour out on us the things that they have that are so obviously needful and even good or rich, but that we can't make happen? Well, if they're in charge of the world around us, and they make things live and thrive in that world, then it follows that they must value those things. They wouldn't go to the trouble of sustaining them, having them be, did they not have some value. And so, maybe what we should do to appease the gods is we should offer them the best of those things, to the degree that that's up to us, so that they know that we are grateful for their favor. Right? So we develop rituals in which we can offer something that we think the god or gods might like, and we make these offerings, and we make them to the rain god, and we make them to the sun god, and we make them to the fertility god, and we make them to the god of war, and we make them, and so on. And all of this is happening in a culture, in the ancient history of humanity. This is happening in a culture of family groups or of tribes. And so we develop these rituals in that context. We develop rituals on the scale at which we're living. So if we're living as a nomadic family, we develop those rituals in the context of a nomadic family. If we're living as a tribe, we develop those rituals in the context of a tribe. One of the things that's intriguing about Göbekli is it's enormous. And as far as we can tell, it wasn't built because people started living there. Göbekli's site, that we've excavated to this point, but less than 5% of the site, about 1 acre. It's about a 22-acre site. And not only have we only excavated about 1 acre of 22, but we've just sort of scratched the surface of that acre. And some of the radar examination of subsequent layers that they've done suggests that there's a whole lot more to dig up. But even what we've dug up so far reveals something that is elaborate, it's extensive. It's the kind of structure that would have required the contributions of hundreds of people to build. It would have required an enormous gathering of people. But there's no evidence on the site or around the site that people actually made civilization there, that they lived there. There's no collection of discarded trash. There's no sites that would suggest that people made shelters there of any duration or spent any kind of continued time there. They came there and they built this thing at a point in history, as far as we can tell, where most of whatever was being acted out that we would call civilization was still happening in relatively small, relatively mobile groups of people. These are people who have not yet discovered agriculture and farming and collective ways of life. People whose religious and ritualistic inclinations would not have logically needed to be collectivized in a megalith like Göbekli. And yet, this is what they did. Alright, so I'm intrigued, and that's nice for me. What does this matter to all of us? Now, I think one of the reasons this is important, this is one of the reasons history matters, but this is one of the reasons this particular bit of history matters, is that it points to ways in which we tend to think as humans, and ways in which we act out of that thinking that seem to have endured. They're not just ancient. They're contemporary. They're still the way we tend to operate. Think of it like this. If you were trying to get the gods on your side, and you believe that an offering of some grain or of the heart of the animal that you've just killed or something like that, if you believe that that kind of an offering would help the gods to be inclined to favor you, then it also follows that if some sacrifice is good when it comes to appeasing the gods, more sacrifice is better. Right? Because if the gods are to be feared, and we tend to fear what we can't understand, and we tend to fear even more deeply that which we can't understand but which we experience as endangering us or having power over us, then it's pretty critical to get whatever we're offering to the gods right. What if a flawed sacrifice sets them off? What if a wrong word in the ritual sets them off? What if coming at the wrong phase of the moon is all it takes for the rain god to be pissed and say, "Not this year, guys"? What if? Because we just don't know what's going to set them off. And conversely, we don't really have any sense of deep confidence about what's going to make them happy. Remember, all of this is unfolding alongside the rest of ancient civilization, and one of the things that is starting to happen as civilization loses its nomadic tendencies is it sheds that way of life and begins to settle in places and to farm there, is that people start to build more permanent dwellings. They don't have to move them all the time. Start to build the things that we would now think of as houses, although they would have been nothing like what we call houses. And one of the things that happens is the civilization begins to lose its nomadic way of life and become more agrarian and more settled and more domestic, is that the people who have more cattle and more sheep aren't wrestling quite as moment by moment to be alive. They've got a little more room to breathe and a little more resource in terms of human power. And one of the things they start to do is they start to build bigger houses, better houses, and in time, more elaborate houses. And the human experience of these increasingly adequate shelters is that that is a good thing. It makes life better. And so it follows that if having a house makes humans have a better life, then building a house for the gods might make them happier too. It might improve their lot, their comfort, their happiness, their largesse. See all the bits fit together? And if a small house is good, and a big house is better, what might come out of the sky that's awesome if we get together and build Göbekli Tepe? If we get together and we build an absolute butt-kicking temple complex, we just knock the temple ball out of the park. We're going to have some happy gods. And we're going to have lots of cattle and lots of sheep and lots of babies that live. And the next time somebody goes to war with us, we're going to flatten them.
We're going to be stronger than them. Let's build a really awesome temple.
So that helps. But we still have this nagging fear that maybe there is more that we need to do. And what happens in human history, in the big story, is that we start to evolve a class of people amongst ourselves that we call priests. And the job of the priests is to make sure we're getting it right. The job of the priests is to make sure that they know what will make the gods happy, and then to make sure we understand what our part is in that ritual, in that way of life, and that we do it, and that we do it right. And we make it possible for the priests to make this their life's work. We support them in a way that allows them to really concentrate on this. Why? Because it's critical. It's essential. It's how we survive. It's how we gain confidence that the gods are appeased. And we give them a special place in which to do it all, and we build it up on a hill like we did with Göbekli. We build it in a location that looks over whatever that geographic region's version of paradise is. The nicest possible place that we could make. Now, what happens to the worship life, to the spiritual life, if you will, of the ordinary person when things unfold like this? Well, more imagination required. We're going to have to start handing out Tylenol. It's a lot of work. Imagine, if you will, this shouldn't be a really big reach in this community, but imagine, if you will, that you're a young woman that's pregnant. And you are glad to be, and you want your baby to live and be well and strong. And you know, because you've watched this your entire life, you know that that's not a given. And you know that somehow in that mystery, there are forces beyond your control that seem to have something to do with it. And in fact, you know that in your culture there is a God assigned to the well-being of your baby. And the way to get through to that God is to leave your home in the village and go up to the hill to the sacred place and make the appropriate sacrifice to the appropriate God so that your baby will be well. So now what we have is a world in which the sacred and the ordinary have been separated. Now what we have is a world where you leave what is ordinary and you go to what is sacred. You leave what is mundane and you go to what is divine. You live with what is everyday and you leave what is everyday if you want to make contact with this unseen realm, with the realm of spirit and the spiritual. I don't know if this is bothering you, but it's bothering me. Give me a moment. You now live in a bifurcated world, a world that is split into two realms. And not only is the world split into two realms, but it's mediated, and it's mediated by a distinct class of people. And so these two worlds don't intersect in the course of common events. You wouldn't take your dog to the temple, and you don't expect the priest to come down from the temple and clean up the mess that your dog made. The ordinary and the sacred don't come together anymore. You know that I've often been on about how God is moving history forward and how that happens with whoever's participating in it, whoever's willing to move. Well, this movement in ancient history of looking at the world around us and recognizing that it contains both the seen and the unseen, that it contains both things that we control and things that we don't, that's one way of understanding that movement.
Because the movement from not acknowledging that the world has things in it that are beyond our control to acknowledging that there are things that are beyond our control, that movement in human understanding is an enormous and significant movement forward. It increases the complexity and the capacity of the world through the view of the humans in the world considerably from its previous understanding. So it's not a bad thing to begin to understand that we can distinguish the seen from the unseen, or that we can distinguish the sacred from the other. That's considerable evolution in human understanding.
It's not a bad thing.
It's an early thing. It's not the squirrel. It's a track.
I'm not even going to start down the path of our modern society's tendency to revisit this. Have you noticed that we seem to have had a tendency for the last few hundred years to regard matter as all there is? Does that sound like devolution? Anyway, we're not going down that path any further than that. Partly because we don't have to, because we're still building infrastructure to distinguish the sacred from everything else. We're still doing it. We still have a class of priests. I'm in it. Jeez. Every once in a while when I have to honestly face these ideas, I think, what are you going to talk about that? You understand? What's going to... Anyways. Intriguingly, it is in the Jesus story that we see another one of these movements. An attempt at shifting a way of looking at the world from where it is to where it needs to go. That's really fascinating and very, very important. Two quick stories from the time of Jesus. One's from Matthew 16, middle of verse 13 to 17:9. Bunch of things happen in that chunk of text. I'm just going to sum them up really briefly. Jesus is with his closest group of followers. They're on a bit of a road trip, which is how they spent a lot of their time. Jesus takes them to this region that the text identifies in Matthew as Caesarea Philippi. It could be a couple different places, but the broad consensus is that this is a location that is sort of right on the edge of what would have been considered legitimate terrain for the Hebrew person. The edge of God's country and all that other country. Not least of all because it's a location that would have been well known as a center for pagan worship, particularly the god Pan. So he takes them to Caesarea Philippi, this spiritually scary or kind of out of bounds area. And then while they're there, he famously and with considerable clarity, as we have the text at least, predicts his own death. And part of what happens in the text, that if you grew up around the stories in the Bible, you will be aware of and recall, is that Peter gets famously fussed with him about it and says, you can't do that. And Jesus gets just as fussed back and says, you're Satan, go away. And they have this little verbal shoving match. And I wish I could have heard these things, because I'd love to know how to have that shoving match and be sinless. Anyway, so they have this exchange. And then, after that happens, Jesus takes them to a nearby mountaintop, which is kind of a sacred place, right? It's another one of these high places. Looks out over the best of the land. He takes them to this mountaintop, and while he's at this mountaintop, he is transfigured. It's some kind of strange mystical thing happens during which Jesus starts to glow, which is, by the way, an intriguing image that filmmakers have found irresistible ever since. And so, like, what, if something spiritual is happening, what do you see, right? So he starts to glow. Elijah shows up. Moses shows up. They have this conversation. And then in Luke's text, the disciples wake up, which is really kind of funny. And then the two old guys are gone, and it's just Jesus. And they're like, what the hell just happened there? That was awesome. Let's what? Let's build something. Let's put up some infrastructure. Right? This is obviously a holy place. What do you do with a holy place? You distinguish it from all the other places. How do you do that? You build a temple. Right? We've been practicing since, how many thousand years ago? This is pretty entrenched by now. And what does Jesus do? He said, no, we're going back down. By the way, don't tell anybody. And where are we going back down to? Right, we're going back down to Caesarea Philippi. What's Caesarea Philippi? Spiritually scary place. A place that good people don't go. People that follow the one true God, they don't go there. That's where we're going. We're not going to stand up here and build something. Right? Sound of screeching great time. Like, you know, that's a... There you go. That's sort of what happens in that text. All right, here's another story. When Jesus dies, One of the accounts of his death
talks about the temple and the curtain ripping. I've always found that an incredibly moving image. Really potent image for me. For whatever reason, it just thrives in my imagination.
Not least of all because I once heard somebody explain that probably the physical structure of this curtain would have meant that it was several inches thick. It's not like somebody tripped when they were taking out the trash and tore the curtain. Right? This is a momentous thing.
And of course, one of the New Testament writers tells us that this is symbolic of it no longer being necessary for there to be a place that walls God off from the people. It's no longer being required that there is a place where the sacred is distinguished from the ordinary everyday, and mediated by this special class of people. But now everyone can have access to God without that mediation and without that infrastructure. Here's one of the interesting implications of that idea. I mean, that's an awesome idea, right? It means we can go straight to God, and we hang a lot on that in our understanding of the story. It also means, by the way, that God is now, in human understanding, running around loose in the world. God is no longer contained by the rituals, by the infrastructure, by the separation from the common. It's important, I think, for me to say that I don't believe God ever was, but I believe we believe God was. I think where we're headed gives us a clue about what's going on here. There's a trajectory to the history of humanity that we can discern in something like Göbekli Tepe, that we can discern in something like our own sacred texts unfolding, that we can discern in something like the world around us and the discoveries we're making about that world, which is why we've been bashing away at quantum physics ideas here for the last few months. It's the same trajectory. And it's a trajectory away from the separation of the sacred and the mundane. It's a trajectory away from the distinguishing of the ordinary and the extraordinary, toward a world that is infused with what is sacred. The ancient sages said, among other things, that when Moses takes off his shoes at the burning bush, it's not because the ground becomes sacred, it's because Moses realizes it was sacred the whole time. And he just had to have a bush on fire that wouldn't go out before he got it. And he went, oh yeah. And so when Moses walks into the court of Pharaoh and says, you got to let my people go, he's not thinking, I'm going from the sacred to the secular. He's not thinking, I'm going from the mundane to the spiritual, or the other way around, the spiritual to the mundane. He's thinking, this is all the terrain occupied by God. And if Pharaoh can't see it, it's going to go hard for Pharaoh. But my job is to say, on this sacred ground, you need to answer to God. Because it's infused with the presence of God. And there is, as Isaiah says, holy, 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 the whole earth is filled with his glory. There is no place that is not infused with the sacred and the divine. What we do with that is another matter entirely. And this is why, among other things, our text, our own sacred text, in its most ancient bits, starts with the pictures of nurturance, starts with the pictures of the garden and of us as the gardeners. Because our job in a world that is infused with what is sacred is to nurture that. Our job is to beat back the things that would choke that out. Our job, our reason for being, is to reveal the beauty of that, the rightness of that, the potency of that. That's why we're here. We're not very good at it, but I would like to think that God and God's goodness is helping us to learn how to be better at it, if we're willing to play ball. And if we, and I'm going to say we as a Christian idea now, realizing that that's not necessarily a descriptor for us collectively, but if those who claim to walk in the way of Jesus believe that that's what we're here to do, but we're not doing it, I don't think we should be the least bit surprised if we see somebody else that doesn't make that claim doing it. If the world is infused with the sacred presence of God, and God is drawing human history forward toward a good end, and God has chosen to work with humanity in that process, and the humans who say we're Christians aren't going to do it, somebody's going to do it. It's going to get done. And I've presented that as an either-or idea, which is rather short-sighted. Not only do I think that is true, but I think it is equally true that there's no exclusive claim that we lay on that intersection as followers of Jesus. We have a particular story out of which we understand that claim and within which we enact that claim. But we do not hold that. That is the thing that is beyond us, because that is the realm of God. But that's what we're looking for. When we stick our nose into the squirrel track, behaving like it's the squirrel, we stop in the wrong spot. When we stick our nose into a religious preference or a theological piece of boilerplate or whatever, and we say, this is it, God's in this squirrel track, we look just as dumb as my little white dog sticking his nose in the snow drift, going, how come there's no squirrel in this one? Right? God's not, the squirrel's not in the tracks. God isn't in the markers. They're markers. When we, and this is so ordinary, I'm just all on with this. When we move in a couple of weeks, one of the challenges that we face logistically about this location is many things that are absolutely fantastic about it. One of the things that's going to take some management is that the entry to it is through a jewelry store. So when we open the door to church, we open the door to a jewelry store. And it's, you know, to the street. So we're going to need to provide some care and attention for that floor while we're in the building. Otherwise, we can't have the door unlocked. We'll talk more about the details of that in terms of people being involved and so on. It's very manageable, but that's going to be one of our challenges. So we're going to come into church past this, among other things, this lovely display of all this line of Pandora jewelry, this bracelet series that you can build these charms up and collect different charms for different things. And beautiful. Popular jewelry line. And we're going to walk past that. We're going to go up some stairs and around the corner into this, into our gathering. If we don't think about it, most of us are going to default to the idea that we are walking through the secular to get to the sacred in terms of space. And I would be willing to suggest that one of the very good reasons for that location to have the shape that it has, one of the very good things that we can take from it, if you will, is almost exactly the opposite of that. We are never, ever, ever walking through a place that is not the place where God resides. When we go to work, we are not leaving the sacred to go to the secular. When we have a conversation with someone, we are never not making words and meaning and connection in a realm where God is not present. But we get to decide if we're going to work for the revelation of that presence, or whether we're just going to ignore it and roar right on by it. Why? So we can get to somewhere where we feel it. I don't know. Because it's just too much work to kind of try to have our imagination going the whole time. So when we walk past the jewelry display, we ask ourselves, where's the presence of the sacred in this? When we get up in the morning and go to whatever our job is, when we, whatever, fill in the blank.
I think that the possibilities of living in a God-infused world are staggering. And if it strikes us as odd that everywhere is sacred, maybe it's because we're still stuck in this idea that God is stuck in religious places and that God is stuck in religious rituals. And like the disciples, we're just having a hard time accepting what Jesus was trying to communicate, that the era where we distinguish the sacred from the secular, for all that it was an important step in human history, was the track and not the squirrel. And it's over and it's done and it's time to move. And that's all I'm going to say about it.